thank you so much for being willing to be interviewed for this great documentary on Is There Meaning in Suffering? Oder Macht Leid Sinn in German? Can we start by you introducing yourself? Who are you? And what should we know about you?
My name is John Lennox, and I am an emeritus professor of mathematics here at the University of Oxford. I'm also an emeritus fellow in mathematics and philosophy of science at Green Templeton College. And I've been in Oxford for the past 25 years or so. I also have an attachment to the business school in Oxford, where I run seminars as an associate fellow. But essentially, I am basically an author and spend quite a lot of time writing books, particularly on the interface between science, philosophy, and religion. And at the same time, doing a lot of Zoom conversations and interviews around the world.
Thank you. Yeah, that's why we have asked you to contribute to this. let's go into the subject. So, suffering. How would you define suffering?
Well, of course, I'm sitting in Oxford, and the Oxford English Dictionary suggests that suffering is having something painful or unpleasant inflicted upon you. And that can either be physical, as in illness or violence, pain, disease, or it could be mental suffering. If you hear, for example, that a friend has just died that's close to you, you will suffer mentally. So there are basically two sources of suffering, the physical and the mental.
Yeah, thank you. You actually have answered question two now, why is there suffering? What are its causes? Do you want to add anything regarding this question?
Well, at the physical level, I think it's important to realize that suffering is, at the first level, a defense mechanism. If I hold my hand a bit too near a fire, then it will begin to burn. And the nervous system will transmit to my brain through the pain that I suffer that something is wrong, so I'll pull my hand away. And in that sense, that basic mechanism is a very good thing indeed, because it saves us from destroying ourselves very frequently. So suffering is a good thing at that level. And you can go a little bit further than that. If you take someone who's a sport fanatic, they're prepared to put up with a great deal of physical suffering and pain in order to develop very strong muscles. And they know that they have to get through that kind of barrier to become experts. Of course, the problem comes when the suffering becomes extreme, and that's where the real big problems exist.
Would you also make a distinction between suffering that is inflicted from human beings, from people, and natural suffering? Would you like to explain that a bit, maybe, like C.S. Lewis does?
There are two sources, it seems to me, of suffering, and it's very important to distinguish them. There are the things that people do to others to make them suffer. Violence, genocide, and all that kind of thing, where humans are directly responsible for the pain and suffering. But then there's suffering that's caused by nature itself. For example, earthquakes, tsunamis, cancers, COVID, etc., etc. And we often call that natural evil. So there are those two. And we can see that moral evil can often lead to natural evil. For example, greedy business people can deforest a country, and that leads to desertification and famine and all that kind of thing. So that moral evil is at the base of something that turns out in the end to be natural evil. But it's also important, it seems to me, to recognize not only these two different sources of suffering, but there are two different ways in which we perceive suffering. There is the viewpoint of the sufferer, and there's the viewpoint of someone who's observing it. Take the COVID situation, for example. It is one thing to be suffering from COVID and being in an emergency situation in a hospital, maybe even dying. It's another thing to be the doctor that's observing it and treating it. And those two perspectives, we need to bear them in mind, because it gives rise to two different kinds of question about suffering. There's the existential problem. That is, I'm in pain and I ask the question, why? The other is, I'm observing pain. How do I treat it? What does it mean? And so there are intellectual questions and there are existential and pastoral questions. And often we need to separate them from one another, because often if a person is suffering intense pain, they don't want to talk about philosophy.
Thank you. Brilliant. When we talk about moral evil, the source of moral evil can easily be understood. Yeah, human beings do evil things. But about natural disasters, it's a bit harder to understand. What would you say? Why are there things like the COVID virus? Why are there earthquakes and tsunamis like right now in the Pacific Ocean? If there is a good God, why do you think that there are these natural disasters which often cause more dead people than moral evils?
We're looking at two scenarios. The problem of moral evil, and C.S. Lewis called natural evil the problem of pain. So we're distinguishing those two questions. And it is very clear that the problem of pain is the harder of the two. It's not that the problem of moral evil is not difficult. It is difficult because it raises the question for a theist, why couldn't God have made people so they don't commit moral evil? And we might come on to that in a moment. But the problem of natural evil is more difficult, in that it seems that the universe, which is neutral, is not so neutral when it comes to imposing pain. And it's very complex to my mind for the following reason. Let's take first earthquakes. I arrived in New Zealand some years ago, a few days after the earthquake that hit New Zealand and many people died. And I was reading quite by accident on the plane going out there about tectonic plates. Now, the Earth has tectonic plates, and geophysics tells us that these are essentially swimming on a magma and they move with respect to each other. And those movements cause earthquakes. And the problem is when people build houses on top of the divides between the boundaries between those tectonic plates. Well, so far so good, but the intriguing thing I discovered, and I've checked it with geophysicists subsequently, is that the movement of the tectonic plates is essential for our atmosphere. In other words, if the tectonic plates did not move, we would not exist. So here's the complexity of the situation. In order to have life as we know it on Earth, you need tectonic plates, so far as we understand. But they can give rise to serious damage and many people dying, earthquakes, tsunamis, and this kind of thing. Now, you could argue, of course, that people oughtn't to build houses in earthquake areas, but then they don't always know that. So if we look at it this way, I find it helpful to think of fracture. The problem of moral evil is a fracture in human nature. People do bad things. But now the problem of natural evil or pain is a fracture in nature itself. And we have to come at those two problems and ask ourselves how we can make sense of them And making sense of them is worldview dependent, as I discovered very clearly when I went to New Zealand. The different competing worldviews, and there are basically three families of worldviews, face these questions in very different ways.
That's a very nice transition. Would you like to tell us which are the basic three worldviews in your view?
Well, let's take the practical situation in New Zealand as I met it. The first was that you get atheists saying, well, that just shows us that God doesn't exist and he doesn't care. And granted, that's just what you'd expect if, as Richard Dawkins is wont to say, the universe is at base just what you'd expect it to be, that it's blind, impersonal forces. They don't know what they're doing, and so things can get completely out of hand, and we shouldn't expect anything else. So that's one viewpoint, and it raises questions that I can come to in a moment if you wish. But then there are people of a more pantheistic point of view, and they argued, and I heard them argue it, that this kind of pain is caused by karma. And if people suffer in this life, that's because they've done something wrong in a previous life and they're suffering from karma. One of the consequences of that is, of course, if you then try to alleviate their suffering, you may be making it even more difficult for them in a future incarnation. It's a pretty awful viewpoint. But there it is. Many people took that viewpoint. And then there were Christians who reacted to the situation and quoted one of the Psalms that says, we shall not be moved even if the mountains fall into the sea. And they found comfort in Scripture. And so you have three sets of problems. Does the atheist point of view make sense? Does the pantheistic view make sense? Or does the theistic view make sense? And I would want to say that most people sit in one of three major worldview families. There are variations, of course. There is the atheistic, its polar opposite is the theistic, which believes that there is a God who created the world and who runs it, so to speak. And then the pantheistic, that says that God and the universe are essentially one, but an impersonal kind of being.
Yeah, thank you very much. Is the existence of God refuted, as you said, atheists claim, by the existence of suffering?
Well, let's first of all take the atheistic claim that says, yes, there is suffering, and in a sense is what you'd expect. Some people might even argue if the universe is the product of natural blind forces, it's amazing that there's so much good in it. But the problem with the atheistic view is this. It claims to solve the intellectual problem of suffering. And I have atheist friends who feel that they have solved the intellectual problem. That's just how it is. But what I notice is they haven't got rid of the suffering. Atheism doesn't get rid of the suffering. And it could be argued that atheism can make the suffering far worse because it has no existential answer to the problem of suffering. It just says that's hard luck. If you're suffering, that is your hard luck. But there's an even deeper problem. Fyodor Dostoevsky once put into the mouth of one of the protagonists in his book, The Brothers Karamazov, the phrase, "Если Бог нет, то и все позволено," if God doesn't exist, everything is permissible. Now, it's important when you read that not to misunderstand it. Dostoevsky did not mean that atheists were incapable of moral conviction or moral behavior. In fact, from where I sit as a Christian, atheists could put me to shame. And in the Bible itself, there are examples of people whose moral standards were higher than those of believers in God, even though they were not believers. And the reason for that, from where I sit, is that all of us, whether we believe in God or not, are hardwired to be moral beings, so that we do have moral standards. Dostoevsky didn't mean that atheists can't behave very well. Of course they can. They're moral beings. What he meant was there's no rational ground for believing in moral standards, in good and evil, if God does not exist. So here's my problem. If the atheist says, look, I don't believe in God because of the problem of evil, I want to say, where did you get your concept of evil from? Because if the universe is just the result of blind forces, how do you get morality from that kind of basic worldview conviction? And the answer is that you cannot. There was a famous philosopher, an atheist philosopher called J.L. Mackey here at Oxford. And he once pointed out that if there are any absolute moral standards, then you can argue very quickly that there must be a God. He didn't believe in God himself, but he could see. Now, I would want to say that all of us recognize certain absolute moral standards. I've never met any sane person that believes that torturing infants or genocide is correct. So there's something that we would be prepared to say is absolutely wrong. So here we have a dilemma with atheism, and I don't see any solution in atheist philosophy to it. And that is, here I am as a moral being. I will condemn evil. I find the problem of pain very difficult because I recognize evil as a moral being. But then if I go down the atheist route, I have no grounds for recognizing moral standards. So it seems to me atheist solution isn't a solution at all.
Yeah, thank you. Very good. Let's come to the Christian theistic view now. So how can you believe in an almighty and good God if there is so much suffering around? Isn't that incompatible?
There's a very ancient problem. Epicurus raised it, Lucretius raises it, and David Hume famously raised it, the 17th century Scottish Enlightenment philosopher. And the idea is simply this. If God is absolutely good and is absolutely powerful, then evil of this kind simply should not exist. And this is a very understandable question. And as a student, I can remember discussing it and arguing about it. And the interesting thing is such arguments never seem to result in anything positive. We never seem to get to a solution. So how do I think about such a thing? Well, clearly, what we've got to do, what any worldview has got to do, is recognize one basic fact. And that is the universe presents us with a mixed picture. I call it beauty and bombs, or beauty and barbed wire. We look at the universe and we see the beauty of the Andromeda galaxy, the beauty of a flower or a mountain scene. On the other hand, we look at news and television and we see tsunamis, we see tornadoes, we see COVID, and we see cancer. It is a mixed picture. And any worldview worthy of the name has got to face that mixed picture. So here's the question I ask myself. Granted that it's like that, and we argue about God, surely an all-powerful good God should have, would have, could have, might have done X, Y, and Z, and we get nowhere. Then the mathematician in me tells me that it is quite possible that I'm asking the wrong question, that you get nowhere with that question. I've never met anyone who did. So I have a different question. But it's equally difficult. I'm not simplifying the question, I'm just changing it. And the question is this: granted that it's like that, that you've got beauty and barbed wire, beauty and bombs. Is there anywhere any evidence that there exists a God who has revealed himself in such a way that we could trust him with this problem? Now, that's a hard question, but I believe that there's a way into that question, which is very helpful, whereas there's no way into the original formulation of David Hume or Epicurus. And so, what is the way in? The way in is something that's absolutely fundamental to Christianity, and that is the notion of a suffering God. A God who came into our world in the person of Jesus Christ and who himself suffered. Now, taking that, let's go to level one. Level one is this, and I always say to people, look, before you reject the Christian explanation, please listen to it, because I fear that many people reject Christianity without ever having listened to its what it has to say. Now, I'm not proposing a solution to this question. That would be naive. I have no simplistic solutions. But what I believe I do have is a window or a door into a possibility of coming to something that at least will give us some existential hope. And that is this, that the fact, the central claim of Christianity is that Jesus Christ is God become human. Now, that is a staggering thing, and I believe it as a scientist, as a professor here in Oxford, and I've argued strongly for that in other films and in my books. But just think for a moment, if that is true, if Jesus is God, then the cross that stood in Jerusalem 20 centuries ago raises the question, what is God doing on a cross? Now, if that is God, it certainly means at the very least that God has not remained distant from human suffering, but has become part of it. Now, that is a staggering advance, it seems, that somehow God understands this. That's step one. Now, step number two is this, and it brings us back to the ultimate fear that lies behind any suffering. If I'm told that I've got a terminal disease, then the spectre that covers all of my thinking from that moment on is the spectre of death. Now, if Jesus had remained on the cross and just died and been buried as he was, and we heard nothing more about him, we'd have heard nothing more about him. But here now comes the big thing that on which everything else turns, and it changes everything, and that is the resurrection of Christ on the third day. Now, that means, of course, that the death barrier has been broken. And to my mind, that changes everything. If the spectre behind suffering and the great fear is that of my personal death and possibly extinction if I'm an atheist, and Christ has broken the death barrier, then that begins to give me hope. You see, what is an atheist to say to a young mother who's dying of COVID? Absolutely nothing. Now, what is a Christian to say? The Christian cannot say, well, you will necessarily be cured. But I believe here is where the Christian message is utterly unique, because it can come to a person and say, even though you may die, you can know a relationship with God that will transcend death, and you can have a certainty of life in eternity by trusting Christ now and repenting of your sin and the mess you've made of your own life and the lives of others, as many of us have done. And God will accept you because of Christ, and he promises that he will raise you from the dead. And that, to my mind, is, well, it's not a simplistic answer, but it's a way in which millions of people have come to terms with the problem of suffering. C.S. Lewis once made the point. He said, people believed this message for thousands of years before there were anesthetics. And it's staggering just to think about that. So that would be the beginning of my way into this, that it's not that it makes it easy, and it's not that we'd suffer no pain, or it's not that I won't die of COVID or something else. But it's that I have a real hope as I sit here. Now, I'm 78 years old, so I'm, by definition, a lot nearer to exiting this world than many people who'd be watching me. But I'm sitting here, and because Christ died and rose again, in that, and of course, there's a huge mystery here, and I'm not ashamed of that either, because if we don't understand even the basic things like energy and light and so on, we're not going to understand this so readily. But the fact is that millions of people who've come to trust Christ have found a relief within suffering that has helped them to bear it and helped them to die with a sense that this is not the end.
I would like to go to one point back, because in other interviews we had already the question of the why do I suffer, why does this and that come?
All suffering faces us as human beings with the question, why? Now, I know, because I spend a lot of time thinking about these things, that there are some people, and the most notable of them is, again, Richard Dawkins, who thinks that the question why is not a legitimate question. Well, of course, if you decide that it's not a legitimate question, you cut yourself off from the whole business of finding a source for meaning, because meaning in life is our answer to the question why. And it seems to me to be absolutely absurd intellectually, existentially, and from every other perspective to deny the question why. And what I think is the denial of the question why is evidence of fear that there might be an answer to it, not simply a relativistic answer, but an ultimate answer. That the why is that God created this universe, that there is a personal God. But that leads to a series of questions that we haven't addressed yet, and they are very important. Let's take the question of moral evil. Why could God not have created beings that didn't kill each other or murder each other? Why could he not have done that? My answer to that may surprise some of you. Of course he could. We can make beings that are non-moral. We often call them robots. They have no moral sense unless we program some morality into them. And here's the very interesting thing, and it's this. If you wish to have a world in which there's no possibility of moral evil, then you are wishing yourself out of existence. You, as a human being, would not exist in such a world. Because the greatest gift I believe that God has given us as human beings is that capacity of a certain freedom of choice, a freedom of will. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because that's what opens up the whole question of meaning. There's no meaning in a robotic life. If I were to arrive at home with my robotic wife and she appears and there's a thing in front of her, a kind of iPad panel, and I press K for kiss and I get a robotic kiss, it would have no significance. It would have no meaning. So the free will question, it seems to me, is central to this. And Lewis saw this and many others have seen this, that what free will opens up is the possibility of love and morality. You see, it means that there is a choice. And it's in choices, in making choices, that we find meaning. One of the deepest meanings of my relationship with my wife is that she, for some reason, chose me, and so on. So I repeat, if we wish for a world in which there was no possibility of moral evil, then we're wishing ourselves out of existence. So now God created such a world, and we have got this marvelous capacity, but we can use it for good or evil. So why did God do it? If we ask the question why again, well, let me come back to myself as a parent and indeed a grandparent. I remember when my first child was born, holding the little girl in my hands, and I looked down at her, and I thought, you know, I don't know why the thought came to me, you could grow up one day and reject me. Well, why have children then? Well, I think most parents know the answer to that. They take a risk, a very real risk in having children, but they hope that their love for that child will be reciprocated and that the child will grow up to love them and bring something into their lives, a family experience that they otherwise would not have had. Now, if we follow that, it's a simple analogy, but it leads us into a bigger consideration. Did God take a risk when he created us as human beings? Of course he did. Of course he did. Just as we take a risk in having children. But then the next logical question to ask is this. If God took a risk, did he make provision if things went wrong? And that's where the Christian message comes into sharp focus. Absolutely, he did. If we've used our freedom, restricted as it well may be, if we've used it to mess up other people's lives and our own lives and to damage the world, then what Christianity offers us is, if we repent of that is turn away from it and admit that it's wrong, but throw ourselves on God's mercy and trust him for forgiveness, then we will receive that forgiveness and a new life and a new power to live. So that God did make provision for when things went wrong. And it seems to me there that we've got a way into understanding something that is utterly profound, but is very real and very meaningful to us, because most of the things that convey meaning to our minds and our experience is, of course, the result of our capacity to choose.
As you have touched the question of meaning, how would you answer the question, is there meaning in suffering, on a personal level or on a global level? How would you answer that question?
I've often thought about the question of meaning in suffering. Now, I've already said that at the base level, there's clearly meaning in us having a nervous system that indicates to us, that warns us, that if we carry on a certain mode of behavior, then we will suffer. That makes perfect sense. But this question of meaning and suffering gets much more difficult when the extent of the suffering seems completely disproportionate. When we see masses of people dying in either genocide or a tsunami, and just the sheer proportion of it we cannot grasp. And this is a very hard problem. And I should have said earlier on that suffering is the hardest problem I face. If I were an atheist, I would, in a sense, have no problem at all, except for the philosophical problems that I've mentioned. But as a Christian, it is a very difficult question indeed. And when you see suffering that is disproportionate, now, Dostoevsky, to quote him again, he made the point. He said he couldn't imagine any great person who had never suffered. And of course, he suffered himself, and many other people have suffered, and showed the rest of us who are weaker exactly what humans are made of. Well, we can begin to understand that in the case of individuals. But what is so difficult is to understand the genocides that have happened in history, or the mass killings. And that leads me back to my key hard question. And it is, granted that it so is, there's bombs and barbed wire and beauty, there's beauty and horrific suffering. Is there any evidence anywhere that there is a God whom we could trust with it? In other words, can we trust God with this apparently disproportionate suffering? Well, if atheism is the solution, then there is no solution, full stop. But it seems to me that Scripture gives us a real hope, since death is not the end. What we cannot necessarily see is what God does with people, especially people who suffer innocently. And I risk saying this, and you may feel that this is going too far, but I sometimes think, as I get older and see the grace and the wonder of what God has already done in many people's lives, that if we could see beyond the death barrier, if we could see into eternity, and if we could see what God has done with those who suffered in these disproportionate killings, the killing fields, the genocides, and all this kind of thing, we just might not have any more questions to ask.
So the natural question regarding this would be, so what evidence do you have that there is an eternity after this death barrier? What would you argue?
Well, the central thing, of course, would be that we face the claim that Jesus was God. The evidence that he was God is that he rose again from the dead. And we're now into a different topic, and that is being convinced that Jesus was raised from the dead.
Give us a few sentences about one or two basic arguments why you think there is good evidence for that.
The evidence for the resurrection seems to me to focus on several things. First of all, there is clear historical evidence, even from outside the New Testament, that Jesus died, he was crucified, he was buried. In fact, it's amazing what ancient historians agree on concerning the historicity of what is claimed in the Gospels. And even strong atheists who are historians will concede that Jesus not only died and was crucified, but that his disciples had a real experience of something after his death. Of course, atheists don't believe that he rose, but that the disciples had very real experiences that led them on a worldwide mission is something they will admit. So one of the evidences of the truth, I believe, of the resurrection is that the tomb was found empty. The first people to spread out a rumor of a resurrection were not the Christians, it was the Jewish authorities, because there was rumors in Jerusalem that the tomb was empty and nobody produced the body. And of course, if the body was still lying in a known tomb, and it was a very well-known tomb. It belonged to an MP, so to speak. So there was no question of what tomb it was. Then they could have scotched any rumour of a resurrection, but nobody produced the body. What happened was that when the early disciples announced that Jesus had risen from the dead, there were many witnesses, that, including the disciples, who spoke to him, met him, talked to him, ate with him after his resurrection. And on the day of Pentecost, when Peter stood up to preach, there was such power in that conviction, because Peter was arguing to Jews from their scriptures, what we call the Old Testament or the Tanakh. He was arguing that they ought to have expected their Messiah to suffer and to rise again. And what had happened in Jerusalem was exactly fulfilling that. Both the suffering and the rising again were part of what had been predicted centuries before by the prophets. That, to me, is a very important piece of evidence. And then, of course, there's the fact of the rise of Christianity, which was a missionary, a proselytizing movement, so to speak, spreading out from Judaism, which was not a proselytizing movement. And the rise of the Christian church is one of the most powerful evidences. Now, of course, you can investigate this from the perspective of ancient history, but it seems to me that the existential investigation is equally important. That is this, that if Jesus really rose from the dead, as Christianity claims, the implication of that is that he's still alive. It's not that he rose from the dead and that's that. He rose from the dead and he's still alive and has the power in his risen, in his resurrection, now in heaven, in the world that we don't see, to change people's lives. And here's one of the things that personally weighs greatly with me, because I've seen it happen so many times in my own life and in the lives of others. For instance, I gave a lecture some years ago, just to illustrate it, at Harvard University to a couple of thousand people. And when I'd finished talking, a Chinese student stood up in the balcony and he yelled at everybody. He said, "Look at me." And we all looked at him, of course. And I said, "Why should we look at you?" There was dead silence. And he was radiant. He said, "6 months ago, Professor Lennox, I heard you speak in the University of Pennsylvania." And he said, "My life was absolutely at the end." And he described various things, that he saw no hope in life, etc., etc. And he said, "Something you said caused me to start to read the New Testament." And in the end, he talked to some Christians and he said, "I became a Christian. Just look at me." And it was one of the most powerful bits of evidence for the living reality of what Christ can do to people. And to my mind, this presents a consistent picture. Christ's claim is, if I repent and trust him, then I will receive various things. I'll receive forgiveness. I will receive peace with God. I will receive a new power to live. And that may convert me from a drug addict to someone who has food on the table or can hold down a job and all this kind of thing. Now, when you observe that many times over and you meet people and 6 months ago they were in a mess and you say, "What's happened to you?" because they're transformed, and they may say something like, "Well, I became a Christian," or "I met Jesus," or "I got converted," or "I was born again." They may describe it in different ways. But what they are saying and evidencing is that Christ is alive and has the power to change them. Well, you see that a number of times, many times in my case. You add 2 and 2 and you get 4. This is, to my mind, the crowning evidence of the resurrection of Christ. And incidentally, for many of those people, it has brought them out of self-inflicted suffering and given them a reason to live so that they can face and help the suffering of other people.